This is an interview with Charles Cox for the SEC Historical Society's Museum and Archive of Financial Regulation. Today is May 14th, 2013. I'm Robert Colby, and today's interview is taking place in the offices of Compass Lexicon in Chicago, Illinois. Mr. Cox, thank you for being with us today.
You're welcome. I look forward to our discussion. Return me to some times that I haven't thought about in that much depth. So let's see what develops.
All right. So I understand that you're originally from Missoula, Montana.
That's correct. Born May 8, 1945. And I had a happy childhood and grew up in Missoula.
Okay. Did you have any interest in economics growing up?
None whatsoever. I didn't really know anything about the field of economics as a social science until I took a course in as a sophomore in college at the University of Washington in Seattle.
And what was it that that kind of drew you to it?
Actually, it was a requirement for business students, and I can remember. Being teased by a friend, you know, saying, "Who did you get for economics?" And I told him, and he said, "Oh man, you're going to work your rear end off, and you won't get any higher than a C." And I said, "I bet I will." And as a matter of fact, I was enchanted by the course, and. You know, one thing led to another, and I ended up switching out of majoring in business and majored in economics. But anyway, it was simply part of the studies I'd undertaken, and okay, time to take economics. So I did, but it changed my entire career.
Well, what was it that fascinated you about it, do you think?
Well, for one, it would be the professor who taught the course. He was well known on campus. His name was Henry Beechel, and at the time, it was the combination, I believe, of the subject matter, which I really found interesting, and the presentation by Professor Beechel. And at the time, I thought that Beechel had the answer to all social problems. You know, that if there was any unemployment, oh, you just jack up government spending a little. If there was any inflation, well, you just cut back on government spending. It was very simple models and so forth. And later, I found out that. Things were a lot more complicated than presented in that course, but I was hooked, and I couldn't get enough of economics. So that I think is the combination of Beechel, which turned out he was the advisor to undergraduates majoring in economics. So he continued to have an influence on me, and one thing I remember in particular. He would look over the courses that you proposed taking for the next quarter, and any that he viewed as a waste of time, and that like being too easy, being ones that were well known around campus as, oh, that's an easy high grade. He would say, "You're not taking that. No, put something else in here." But that was really valuable. Mm-hmm. I liked it. I explored fields that I had never thought about. For example, some courses in the English department. Probably I would not have gone there if it weren't for a gentle push. Philosophy courses, certain courses in science. So I would say that that not only did I learn about economics, but the path I followed and the influence of Professor Beechel got me to learn how the world works as I would determined, as opposed to being fairly narrow in my interests and mainly looking at it as ticking off requirements for a degree. Also, as an undergraduate, I came under the influence of a number of other professors who, to this day, I value their influence on me. For example, Judy Thornton and Yoram Barzel. I noticed last year in a newsletter from the economics department at the University of Washington that they were recognized for being professors there for 50 years. And as a matter of fact, I saw them last summer, and it was my pleasure to once again tell them that I appreciated their influence. So I would say that it was kind of those developments, and I think that the economics department was a good place to be at that time for an undergraduate, and certainly for me personally, just everything about it, I have nothing but good memories and value the education I got there.
Did any of them specifically encourage you to pursue advanced education in economics?
I think it was more my decision. I liked the idea of continuing to explore economic problems the way I had as an undergraduate, and thought graduate studies would be even more interesting, but they were certainly supportive. I don't think that anybody took me aside and said, you should go to graduate school. Mm-hmm. It was more as I expressed an interest. Mm-hmm. They certainly thought, had good things to say and encouraged me to go ahead. So supportive, but they didn't cause me to follow that path.
So how did you end up at the University of Chicago?
It was, I think by the time that I was doing my applications to graduate school, I had pretty much decided that I was interested in the kind of mix of theory and empirical work that was emphasized at the University of Chicago. I was interested in some of the professors that were there, but that doesn't mean to say that I didn't cast a wider net. Mm-hmm. But overall, when I got my offers and sorted through them and thought hard about it, I decided that the University of Chicago was the place for me, and I got a good offer. But I got good offers elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But the total mix led me to select the University of Chicago, and I was always happy that I did. I had a great time as a graduate student.
Were there particular things that you wanted to explore?
I was very interested in the area of industrial organization and the kind of overlapping area of law and economics, as I had come to experience that in a somewhat limited way as an undergraduate. So that in particular was an attraction at the University of Chicago, and my ideas that would be a place to explore it were satisfied that was important at Chicago at the time, and I got plenty of training in that area.
Did you work primarily with George Stigler, or did you work with other people as well?
Well, George Stigler was the advisor for my dissertation, and I had the idea of taking courses from him, and and also pursuing studies with him. Mm-hmm. There were other people on my dissertation committee, for example, Lester Telser and Ruben Kessel, both of whom I appreciated their input very much. There were, and of course, there was a real lineup of what I think is economic stars at the University of Chicago at that time. I took courses in, for example, economic history from Robert Fogel. I took courses in monetary economics from Milton Friedman. But there was, you know, there was continually something of very interesting to study, to pursue, and in one sense, sort of the graduate student period of my life, where I had very few responsibilities other than to do exactly what I wanted and study just what I wanted, was a very happy time.
How did you choose your dissertation field?
Searching around, I guess like a lot of graduate students, you're kind of thinking, well, you know, what would my topic be? And I had a couple that were, you know, kind of false starts. They weren't really mm-hmm. going anywhere. But then I said, you know, I'm interested in financial markets. I'm interested in law and economics. And Chicago, I'd always been a bit fascinated by the idea of futures trading, probably because it seemed kind of esoteric mm-hmm. and just what goes on with this. It is kind of a, you know, a financial mm-hmm. area. And so I thought about exploring research topic there, and I became interested in why there was futures trading in certain products mm-hmm. and wasn't in certain others. And that's not the topic that I explored, but I narrowed it down because I also became interested when I found out that there had been legislation passed that prohibited futures trading in onions. And, you know, and so I thought, you know, there's a number of agricultural products in which there's futures trading, and there was mm-hmm. regulated futures trading, but why a ban on futures trading in onions? So that kind of what got me started about this, and the idea of certain claims that were made about the effect of futures trading on the spot prices for commodities. Now, keep in mind that what I studied was mainly commodity, futures trading in commodities. Futures trading in financial products hadn't really developed mm-hmm. to the stage where that's the main show in futures mm-hmm. trading now. But I was saying, and I found a data set on spot prices that I thought would be useful. So it all kind of came together mm-hmm. that all right. One of the main claims was that futures trading destabilized spot prices, but on the other hand, we know that information is important to financial markets, and doesn't futures trading help with price discovery and provide more information? So I was studying the effects of futures trading and market information through the behavior of spot prices, and that is what was in my dissertation. And so it combined areas. I said, you know, as I mentioned, I was interested in learning more about futures trading. I was interested in applying some of the ideas or techniques of law and economics to that mm-hmm. area. And so there it was. That was the dissertation I pursued.
Well, and law and economics was sort of an emerging field at this point.
It was. I mean, it had been around for a while, but I think, you know, really the development, I think, was beginning to gain momentum, especially at the University of Chicago. And I attended a weekly seminar that was mainly in that area, although I believe it was called the Industrial Organization Workshop. But it was this expansion, this movement into the area of law and economics, mm-hmm. and you would see people who are you know, the major names, and or at least recognized as past major names now, attending regularly. Mm-hmm. So again, another happy circumstance of my time as a graduate student at the University of Chicago.
Sure. And so you finished your dissertation. How did you come to be at Ohio State?
Just the job search process. Uh-huh. I would say that all things considered, it was the best offer that I got, mm-hmm. and so off I went to Ohio State. There were some friends there that mm-hmm. I knew, and that too, it turned out to be a good experience. Mm-hmm.
Did you find yourself mostly teaching undergraduates there, or working with graduate students, or a combination?
I taught both at the graduate and okay. undergraduate level, both theory and some of the more applied areas. Mm-hmm. I taught courses in price theory, I think it's often called microeconomics mm-hmm. now. I taught introductory economics to large classes and small classes. I taught courses in banking and financial markets. I taught some honors courses. So there was a mix, and as I said, both at the graduate mm-hmm. and undergraduate level. And again, since you've asked, I think that one thing, since I hadn't done any teaching at the University of Chicago, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of universities, the graduate students are teaching assistants or actually teach some of the mm-hmm. the courses, and at the time at Chicago, there were no teaching assistants. So it was a new experience for me, preparing courses and interacting with the students. So I appreciated both from the graduate level and what they brought to their interest in the field, and the undergraduate level, which of course had a wider mix of mm-hmm. of people. There were a lot of reasons why they might be in a mm-hmm. course.
Were there things that you particularly enjoyed about it?
I did. I enjoyed especially people who sort of begin to see the world as an economist mm-hmm. and were as intrigued by it as I had yeah. been as an undergraduate. Now, of course, you know, in a large university like Ohio State, there's sort of a normal distribution of students, and a lot of them are there simply because it's a requirement. But a lot of them would be in an economics class, and maybe they hadn't realized about the way of economic thinking or some of the insights. And to see them learn this or begin applying it on their own was particularly satisfying.
Sure. And you were there for 8 years?
About that, I believe.
Okay. And then how did you go from there to Texas A&M?
There are a number of reasons, but one of the prime ones that I would point to is that there in the business school and in the management department in particular, there was a group of really economists developing a law and economics.
That's at Texas A&M.
Developing law and economics. And as I said, it was kind of surprising. It was in the business school. Mm-hmm. I found that attractive, and an opportunity to experience a place that I'd never had any experience mm-hmm. with. I'd never even been to Texas
right.
before I visited Texas A&M. This set of courses, and it was both at the graduate and undergraduate level, which I don't think it was called law and economics, but that's really what it was. And in addition, Texas A&M made me an offer that would be hard to refuse. So anyway, I moved on to Texas.
Was there a reason that there was was there a conscious attempt to get law and economics sort of grouped together at Texas A&M, or did it just sort of congeal?
I think that there was the idea, particularly by one of the members of this group, Jerry Kahn, that it would be useful for business students to understand the law and economics approach, and to ask hard questions about regulation, to realize what it is, kind of how important it is to businesses, to industries, why some regulations develop as they do, or what the forces are. That in other words, it's not just a parameter that's given, but there are actually reasons why regulations develop in one particular way rather than another. And so I believe that this was the idea going on at the time, and it was an attractive area in which to work.
Mm-hmm. And so you found yourself teaching in the business school, and was that different than teaching sort of standard economics?
Not really. I'd say that the breadth of what I taught was narrower because it was really more the law and economics. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, again, kind of a normal distribution of students, some
sure.
who are really interested in matters related to economics, some who couldn't have cared less.
And so you're there for a couple of years. How did you make the jump from there to the SEC?
That's an interesting question. I was at a program, I believe it was called Law for Economists, and the telephone in my room rang, answered, and it was assistant to the chairman of the SEC, who tracked me down at this conference and ask if I were interested in considering the job of chief economist at the SEC. And so I said, well, I would certainly be interested in talking about it more. Do that? So one thing led to another, and eventually I was the chief economist at the SEC.
Had you ever met Chairman Shadd before?
No, I had not. The way it panned out is we made a date for me to go to Washington D.C. and to talk to people at the SEC. And I remember that it was a fairly short meeting with Chairman Shad, but I also talked to a number of other people, perhaps at the level of division director, at least one commissioner, perhaps more than that, but a number of people. I spent the day interviewing there, and when I was done, I thanked the people who had handled me and went back to Texas with the idea, well, this was interesting, but I was unsure that I wanted to pursue it. And then maybe a couple of weeks later, I got a call and said, well, would you be willing to spend Saturday, the such and such, in New York with Chairman Shad? And I thought, all right. And so we spent the day together drinking iced tea and talking about tremendous variety of things. I guess that's really what finally convinced me to go there is just the ideas that we had, that we exchanged about the possible role that economics could play at the SEC, what role it was playing, what his vision was, and that's how that developed.
Well, I'd be interested to hear what role was it playing at the SEC?
There was a group, and I believe it was called the Directorate of Economic and Policy Analysis. But they didn't really apply kind of the latest techniques in economics, financial economics, and so Chairman Shad was interested in having a chief economist, an office of the chief economist, where we would focus on bringing some of the current thinking of financial economics to issues that the commission was dealing with, both in the area of proposed rules or the functioning of rules that were in place, and just various topics related to financial markets that were of interest to the commission, and so that was as he saw it, it would kind of pump up the level of economics at the SEC.
Is it supposed to? Would you say it's supposed to bring sort of a extra level of thought to rules before they went out?
I think that was the view because remember. There were, I don't know how many, five economists and how many, hundreds of attorneys, and that was the situation. It was basically a regulatory agency whose purpose was interpreting and enforcing the federal securities laws. And that was done mainly by attorneys, but the idea was that to have some input that was kind of my job as I went there as chief economist.
Were there particular things that that Chairman Shad kind of saw on the horizon that he thought would need economic analysis applied to them, or was this just something he thought was lacking?
I think it was more the latter, that he thought it would be useful to have this input and to be developing it. It wasn't going to appear full blown and be a major part of the commission, but to kind of nurture it and see where it where it fit in and what it could contribute, which is what I attempted to do as chief economist, both by attracting some people to come work there, and by attempting to make some contribution. And I think one of the areas that that we began with in the office of the chief economist was the topic of shelf registration, which the idea was to expand it, the availability for issuers, and there the idea, could we do any studies, could we do anything that would contribute to this rulemaking process? So we began to work on that and had some contributions about the because there was a pilot program and what the effects of the pilot program had been. So that was one of the first tasks that we tackled.
So I guess the office of the chief economist is a new entity at this point.
At the time, yes.
And right. So did you have to set sort of protocols for how it was going to work, or?
Yes. I mean, it was. You're probably sounding a little more formal than it actually was. It was like finding economists that were interested in coming to work there. Finding a way to get in on the process, of which I must say that it wasn't really the most welcome of environments, and perhaps that's typical of any organization when you've got say a division that is preparing a rule or operates a certain way, to have some newcomer say, well, let me give you some suggestions on that. I'm sure they say, we don't want your suggestions. So there was some of that, but there was also working with the economists, especially where people in the operating division saw that it could be useful to what they were doing. There was, and I don't want to make that seem more serious than it was, because, but it's just kind of the way an organization works. As this little operation with some people who might have had some different ideas, you kind of have to balance off and become accepted while you're making a contribution. All of it, an interesting and educational process for me.
Did you have your input into the process primarily through studies, or was it more informal than that?
Some of both, but I viewed it as mainly studies that. Again, we may have been kind of consulted for an opinion, but it was mainly, can we bring empirical evidence to bear on a topic like how shelf registration was working, for example, and so it was more. It was more formal in that writing a study and having that be part of what the commissioners mm-hmm. considered before making a decision.
So it was they weren't coming to you and saying, give us your best guess on what you think is going to, what you think effect this will have?
No, not really.
Okay.
But, there may have been sometimes I can remember being in discussions with someone who perhaps come to see the chairman, and mm-hmm. and this was just kind of a, you know, a back and forth, but more like a discussion where as chief economist I might have been kind of bringing in some sort of the economist view, mm-hmm. But it wasn't a lot of talking to commissioners and giving best guesses. That would have been a small, if any, okay. part of what I did.
So you talked a little bit about shelf registration. What were some of the other issues that you studied while you were in the economist's office?
Well, what was... important at the time was the idea of tender offers, corporate takeovers, the market for corporate control, mm-hmm. which is an area that was had been generating a lot of research in financial economics and was also generating a lot of interest at the SEC mm-hmm. Because if you go back to this time, 1983, 1982, there would have been some of the high profile corporate takeovers, hostile takeovers, and it was generating a lot of interest in the business community, in the political arena, and so that was an area that of which the SEC was getting there were more and more issues coming mm-hmm. up about related to tender offers and the commission's authority, the effects of tender offers, and so that was an area also that that was developing and in which we began to do some work.
You said that it was generating a lot of research at the time. Had it been well studied before the early 80s? Or?
I don't think so, because it hadn't really been. Let me detour a little
sure.
bit. Because, you see, what was going on is that methods of financing were becoming available that hadn't been widely available in the past. So it was making it possible for a person to finance a hostile takeover that wouldn't have been possible before. And what I'm talking about here is the whole area of high-yield bonds, or in popular terminology, junk bonds.
Sure.
And so that you had various entrepreneurs making these offers for a company, and this was raising questions that was this beneficial? Was it beneficial for shareholders? Was it beneficial for the company, or was it detrimental? And now, a company that for which a hostile offer was made. Viewed this as a very threatening thing. The whole management team was you know could have been thrown out by it. So, like I said, there were questions of you have to do something to stop this, while there were also views that it was beneficial, that it was allowing opportunities for corporate control that hadn't been available before, but that would have been beneficial to shareholders, beneficial for the use of resources. And so this is what was going on at the time. And the commission was playing a part in it. There was activity or thoughts about this both at the congressional level and at the regulatory level, and part of that would have gotten to the Tender Offer Advisory Committee, which the SEC put together. So that was the situation at the time. And I think where I diverged was where you'd ask that had it been studied, had the market for corporate control been thoroughly studied prior to the 80s, and I don't think it was really. I think there had been some studies, but it wasn't really a hot topic because there wasn't that much activity in the market for corporate control.
So how did you go about studying it?
Well, remember, we were still pretty small. Mm-hmm. The office of the chief economist. I was recruiting people. I was overseeing some studies. But I think that one area that we participated in a support way, and not as directing it, but was this Tender mm-hmm. Offer Advisory Committee, and so that was one of the main areas.
Can you tell me a little more about the advisory committee?
It wasn't really something that the chief economist or the office of the chief economist was. So it was more put together by the commissioners, and remember I said kind of a support mm-hmm. role, but the fact that it drew interest from the financial community, mm-hmm. the business community, academics, it was these kind of things putting together this advisory committee and tackling some of a whole list mm-hmm. of the questions that had been facing the commission mm-hmm. is one of the ways that it was studied. Now, I'm not claiming that this was the office of the chief economist's mm-hmm. study of it. We couldn't have done that with 3-5 people, something like that, mm-hmm. Because it was a bigger operation than that. So, with the general support of the commission staff, this group was put together, and they began working through various mm-hmm. questions.
And so, the advisory committee ended up putting out quite a great many recommendations, and by that point you're on the commission, right? So you had to deal with the fallout from the committee.
That's correct. By the time that sort of the results of the advisory mm-hmm. committee became available, I was a commissioner rather than the chief economist.
And how did you become a commissioner?
I got a phone call one day, and it was someone from from the White House Office of Presidential Personnel, and they said, would you please come over and have lunch? And, you know, sure, that sounded pretty interesting, and I did. And during lunch, I was asked, would you be interested in being one of the commissioners? And I can remember, I said, well, yes, I would. I think I could do a better job than some who are currently commissioners. And that was the start of kind of a long path that eventually led to me being nominated by the president and mm-hmm. eventually confirmed by the Senate.
So how did the view differ from being a commissioner as compared to being the chief economist?
Well, as a commissioner, I was involved in everything. Mm-hmm. As chief economist, it was pretty narrow to designing research projects and manning those projects. As a commissioner, you're making decisions based on the input of the staff and kind of sifting through both the legal mm-hmm. and to the extent that there was some economic information. Mm-hmm. So it was much more of an overview of mm-hmm. everything that the commission was doing as opposed to simply financial economics approach.
Sure. So, as you said, the issues are much broader when you're a commissioner. But some of them are sort of the same. I mean, you're dealing with the same issues. The same issues, just more of them.
Yes, but you've got to realize that as chief economist and as developing the office of the chief economist, and I've mentioned a couple of times how it was a very small mm-hmm. operation at the time. It kind of had the luxury to focus because you couldn't focus on everything. Mm-hmm. You have to focus on everything as a commissioner. Right. And there are decisions to be made. The mm-hmm. the world moves on. You can't mm-hmm. say, "Well, I would really like to study this at greater length." There comes a time you're making a decision right. with the best information you have.
Right. So when you step up to being commissioner, what are some of the major issues that you're facing?
Well, I think so.
We talked a little bit about the tender offers.
The tender offers. I was going to go to that, but mm-hmm. I was trying to think of were there others at the time. I do remember tender offers and kind of having a difficult time thinking of some of the other rulemaking or regulatory issues from right at that time.
Well,
and remember, another thing that you get into as a commissioner that really wasn't part of my work as chief economist was the decisions about enforcement mm-hmm. of whether to sue an individual or a company for violating mm-hmm. the securities laws.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big part yeah. of what the mm-hmm. commissioner does, that that as the economic staff at the commission developed, they had some input into this, and it became more over time. But enforcement actually found that there are very useful aspects of financial economics for it, and so something that had been viewed with skepticism, I actually think that that it became to be viewed as very convenient by the enforcement staff in particular situations, and that analysis of stock prices, breaking down movements in stock prices as to what explains these movements, and so certain people in the enforcement division begin to wake up to the fact that economists could be helpful to what they were analyzing. By that time, I think I was really a commissioner and kind of separated from the actual day-to-day analysis of these things.
That's something that technology would have helped with as well, because you were there when EDGAR was implemented also.
that's a good question. EDGAR. Perhaps an interesting story. I can remember at some conference speaking about EDGAR, and I was actually ridiculed in some newspaper stories for wasting the conference's time on such a silly topic as EDGAR. But realize, as I'm sure you do, that the whole idea of EDGAR was to computerize the disclosure documents. And I've often thought back that what if we hadn't started that? What if we had kind of taken the cue that how silly to be wasting time on having registration statements or periodic disclosures available via computer? I find it unimaginable how things could work without that.
Right.
I mean, because you were really faced with going to a regional office and saying you wanted a copy of the document. It was all paper, and it absolutely could not work. Whereas now people think nothing of accessing, you know, any of the disclosure documents online, but yet this was viewed as something that the commission shouldn't have been wasting time on such a frivolous project, and I think it couldn't work with the disclosure documents if they were in paper form. Think about it. People want that immediately. Mm-hmm. They don't want to like send away and wait for documents to arrive. They don't want to go to a regional office. You just get it online. So that was very important, and it was at the behest of Chairman Shadd, where he said, "Look, we've got to get going on this." And now I'm not saying that the staff wasn't behind this, but it was just viewed as kind of like so peculiar. Why would this be something that this regulatory agency was concerned with? Well, I think that the way it's panned out, it's absolutely clear that you can't think of it in the situation if there wasn't EDGAR and the computerized filing and handling of the registration and periodic disclosure documents.
Right. Something else. So as we talked about earlier, integrated disclosure would have been done before you got to the commission.
Integrated disclosure was being put into place.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
One of the primary people behind that was Lee Spencer, who was director of the Division of Corporation Finance when I went to the commission, and he was one of the people pushing in this direction. Mm-hmm. But another important area mm-hmm. that I think makes complete sense, because again, from the standpoint of a financial economist, you're talking about how information is mm-hmm. important. Well, it doesn't really matter whether the information was segregated into registration statement or periodic disclosures. It's all information mm-hmm. and would contribute to the total mix and be important to market participants. And so I think it was that integrated disclosure, again, it was a very important mm-hmm. Development, but it was not something that either as chief economist or as commissioner that I somehow promoted or pushed. It was pretty much sure. in place, or the idea okay. that it was being implemented and put in place mm-hmm. by the time I got to the SEC.
So if you don't mind, if I jump back to we were talking earlier about the tender offers, and you and the commission had to look at the recommendations put forward by the advisory committee. What were the main debates about how the commission should act on tender offers?
I think the main debates were over whether the SEC should make the tender offer process more complicated, or whether the SEC should put in place, have protections for investors, but let the process work mm-hmm. Otherwise comparatively unimpeded. And I think simply that's kind of the situation that existed, and overall, I think it was the decision came to be made that the recommendations, and realize these were recommendations for legislation, mm-hmm. not so much rulemaking, should there be legislation that authorized kind of an extensive intervention, or were there certain things that should be done, but otherwise leave the process to the market for corporate control, and so that's. In short form, the description of what the commission mm-hmm. was faced with.
Well, there's also jurisdictional questions, right? As in terms of what should be done by a federal agency and what should be left to the different state regulations.
Oh, there, yes, because basic corporate regulation is a state issue, and so there was the question of state versus federal, and how much the federal securities laws mm-hmm. could do versus how much was a matter for state corporate law. Yes, you're correct on that.
And then a great deal of that was set out, if I recall correctly, was set up by, was sort of, I don't know if it was settled exactly, but by the Delaware court in some decisions.
Well, to the extent that it is a matter of state corporate law, mm-hmm. And Delaware being one of the primary mm-hmm. Residences for major corporations, Delaware had a major influence into what was allowed or wasn't allowed for corporations, and especially in the area of tender offer protections. Mm-hmm. But that was an issue that from the standpoint of investor protection, what could the SEC do or should do, mm-hmm. and versus what was really an area of state law and a matter for states to consider, and for corporations then to abide by the state law. So that was all going on during this time, you know, from when I became a commissioner, probably, you know, for the next several years.
Would you say that the commission's position evolved over that time?
I think it evolved to the extent that there would be new issues, mm-hmm. periodically, because nothing sits still. So you deal with the new issues, the new areas, but it was, in some sense, it was the various market participants coming up with new ideas, new attempts at takeovers, new ideas for thwarting takeovers. But I think it was all important for that to develop, and the various inputs. I think it would have been worse to have some central and relatively small authority making the decisions. I think that just from the standpoint of the diversity of the various participants was important, and the interactions, state versus federal, the financial markets versus the corporations, mm-hmm. All of it played a role, and I think that by having a relative monopoly on ideas, that the outcome would have been worse than what did develop.
One of the other issues from a governance perspective at this time is the one share, one vote that the stock exchange put forward.
Yes. That was... I did find that interesting. And my views on it are the following, that it's related to the takeover area because some companies were finding to have non-voting shares or super voting shares was a valuable anti-takeover mechanism. But the New York Stock Exchange had a rule that there would be one vote per share for companies listed on the NYSE. But what had been going on was NASDAQ, as an alternative, had developed to the place where it was truly competitive, not just for new or developing corporations, but for mature corporations. Mm-hmm. And NASDAQ didn't have such a rule. Mm-hmm. So part of this was due to competition in the markets for stock, mm-hmm. That the New York Stock Exchange said, wait a minute. We're finding that there are companies that will stay on NASDAQ as opposed to moving to the New York Stock Exchange. Mm-hmm. we want to change this rule. So then that developed the idea of, well, what about this? Should there be one vote per share? Mm-hmm. And the SEC got involved because the rules of exchanges and the markets for stock come under its authority. But the SEC wouldn't have had the authority to set the standards for corporations. It was a matter of state law. Mm-hmm. And so my views were different than the other commissioners on this, where I said that it should be that the commission was trying to do by the back door mm-hmm. what it couldn't do by the front door in setting one vote per share. Mm-hmm. It was attempting to do it through the back door by requiring exchanges to have a rule saying to be traded here, whether it's on the New York Stock Exchange or on NASDAQ, a company has to have one vote per share. But my view was if the shareholders, if it's fully disclosed mm-hmm. and the shareholders decide that that isn't what they want, mm-hmm. Then as long as it abides by state corporate law, the shareholders should decide. It's not, we're not talking about voting in the sense of how there's one vote per person in a democracy. People have acquired these votes by purchasing the shares. Mm-hmm. So it's not something you're born with as a citizen. Mm-hmm. It's a financial right. transaction. And so I saw no reason why there couldn't be diversity in how corporations were set up. Mm-hmm. And the market itself would decide, subject to state corporate law, how the companies mm-hmm. were capitalized, what the votes per share would be, and as long as it was fully disclosed, then other market participants could decide whether or not they wanted to invest mm-hmm. and at what price they would pay for the company's securities. So, I opposed the commission's efforts to impose rules on exchanges mm-hmm. requiring one vote per share.
Do you think in the years that this was happening, the market was suggesting that it would tolerate multiple classes of stock, or do you not see that as the case?
Yes, I believe that. And there were studies mm-hmm. to this effect, not just tolerate, but that in a number of instances, a vote was not valued very much by investors. And my view was that as long as there was a thriving markets, that there was room for differences in this, and that if shareholders in a corporation wanted to have different classes of stock, that should be their decision, as long as people knew what they were getting. And so this is one instance where I didn't have views similar to mm-hmm. to the other commissioners.
One of the other issues that's tied to the to tender offers and takeovers is the insider trading scandals from the 80s. I'd be curious to get your take on how you saw them from the commission.
Of course there was this going on, and where there are such newsworthy events as a tender offer and with a control premium and so forth, there was a tremendous incentive for people who were not law-abiding market participants to use this to their personal advantage. Mm-hmm. So at the same time that there were these various issues about how tender offers should work and were tender offers good or bad, there were also people with access to this information that were using it in violation of the rules against insider trading. And if you go back and look at this period, there are various investment bankers and then on to Ivan Boesky, and so here you had enforcement issues that were related to tender offers, takeovers, and so forth, especially in the area of insider trading.
And it's complicated because there was a lot of debate about how to. I mean, obviously, the commission was expected to enforce the rules, but there was some dispute about what the rules should be.
I guess I'm not understanding completely, because certainly we were enforcing mm-hmm. the rules against insider trading. Right. Are you suggesting that there was?
I'm thinking more of the dispute about what exactly the definition of insider trading was.
Okay, that I saw as an issue. Because, especially during this time period, people were being sent to jail. Mm-hmm. In other words, criminal charges were being brought, people being sent to prison mm-hmm. Related to insider trading, and yet there wasn't a definition of insider trading. And to me, it was important that especially where there are criminal consequences of violating the law, I think the law should be clearly stated. Mm-hmm. And from that view, I supported a definition of insider trading. There was an alternative view that if illegal insider trading were defined, then people would find a way around that. But really, I viewed it as more a job of the law of saying mm-hmm. what you shouldn't do, and then if people are finding a way to circumvent that, fix that, mm-hmm. but not keep it vague mm-hmm. so that you can catch people. Mm-hmm. I mean, right. it's almost like the cartoon of the little town that has a speed trap, you know, where the policeman hiding behind the billboard. So there was this debate, and that was an interesting time. As you probably know, the commission proposed a definition mm-hmm. of insider trading, and we worked very hard on it. It was a fairly short time frame, and I can remember, continual meetings and to hammer out a proposed mm-hmm. definition of insider trading.
Mm-hmm. Which ultimately didn't make it into the law.
That is correct. The Congress chose not to define mm-hmm. insider trading. And one of the reasons that I heard, although I couldn't tell you that this was the reason, because there's usually a variety of reasons mm-hmm. for what Congress does or doesn't
right.
do, is the very thing I mentioned, that if insider trading were clearly defined, then some people would be able to figure out a way around it.
Mm-hmm.
I've already said I disagree with that
right.
view, but that is one that I heard at the time, and there wasn't mm-hmm. a definition adopted by Congress. Perhaps just through the development of the law up to this time, perhaps it is more clear now than it was at the time, but I still believe that fairness and justice would have been served by mm-hmm. Having a definition of insider trading.
Now, for a while during this period, you are the acting chairman. How did that come to be?
I was the senior okay. commissioner,
okay.
But I was appointed acting chairman okay. by the president,
okay.
and so again, that was an interesting experience. It was not so much different, except more testimony before mm-hmm. Congress, and a concern with the budget
okay.
more than the commissioners are, so that those were two mm-hmm. areas that I noticed more, and also the chairman sets the agenda, but I don't think there was any real agenda setting to either like keep things away from the commission or bring particular mm-hmm. things before the commission, so that prior to becoming acting chairman, I don't think that went on, and I certainly didn't play any games with the agenda.
One that raised a question on it: as a commissioner, are the responsibilities for the different divisions sort of divvied up between the commissioners?
No, not at all.
Okay.
It would be, you're involved in everything,
okay.
All aspects of the regulation, mm-hmm. and I think that's a good idea,
mm-hmm.
Because then if you really had like one commissioner for corporation finance, one commissioner for a different division, I just think it would be, there'd be less diversity, mm-hmm. less mixing of ideas,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's better to have the commissioners mm-hmm. involved in all of the areas.
I just didn't know if some were seen as having like different expertise or things like
They might have taken more interest
okay.
in one or the other, but still, it was mm-hmm. it's full participation in all the decisions according as far as rules or enforcement matters.
Mm-hmm. There's a couple other things I'd be interested in. I'd be interested in hearing your perspective on the market break and what that was experiencing. That was like at the commission.
That was a very interesting experience. This would have been in 1987. And at the time, I think that one aspect involved was perhaps an over-reliance on the idea of portfolio insurance. This would have been using financial futures as a way that was supposedly supposed to work to prevent losses on a portfolio of stocks. And so using futures combined with investing in stock. But I think another aspect here was market capacity. And when you looked at the capacity of the various stock markets at the time and compare it to now, when you look at the volume of trading mm-hmm. and that kind of thing, it's a mind-boggling difference right. in the amount of capacity that the markets had. And so when there was really this crunch of people trying to adjust positions quickly, the capacity wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And so that generated some statements about closing the markets mm-hmm. and that kind of thing, which I think caused some people to panic. So there was the market break in 1987, and interestingly enough, then there was a debate over, well, was it these financial futures that were the cause? Was it capacity? So there was that kind of debate. Mm-hmm. But when you begin looking at the proposals or the ideas that came out of this to fix things, it was surprising that most of them had been around for a long time, and it was kind of like bringing out not something directly aimed at what the problem was mm-hmm. with the market break, but here's a good chance to institute this regulation that we've been pushing for years.
Never and let a crisis go to waste.
That's yes, it was educational as to that is really a true statement that you see things being brought around as to, well, here's a chance to do some widespread, you know, fine-tuning and modifications of regulations. So let's put this one in the hopper.
What sorts of things were people looking to put in?
It's a little too detailed for me to recall. But I do know that at the time it was not just focused on okay. on what had happened and what could prevent that a repetition. Mm-hmm. It was as much that well, here's something from a few years ago that never has generated much interest. Why don't we have that? You'd say, mm-hmm. how's that related to the right. market break? Well, it isn't really, but it would be nice to have. Anyway.
One of the other things that struck me is it seems like in this time period there's kind of periodically there are different groups surface, and the question is, what is the role of the SEC in regulating either futures or financial advisors or things like that? It seems like there's sort of an ongoing discussion about who or what does the SEC have jurisdiction over.
That's become more of an issue maybe lately. Okay. Back at the time, there was this question about futures, especially with the development of financial mm-hmm. futures and the SEC. I know that since I had written a PhD dissertation regarding futures trading, that some of the interests in the futures area had decided that the reason I was at the SEC is to help the SEC take over regulation of of futures trading. And I remember people coming to visit me, I guess you would say, perhaps lobbyists or whatever for related to the futures industry, and actually putting the question to me. And I said I thought it was a happy coincidence that I had some knowledge of the futures markets, but my role was not to somehow help the SEC make an attack on the areas of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. And if you look at the news accounts there, back before I arrived at the SEC, there was an accord between the SEC and the CFTC over areas of regulation, and that continued the entire time that I was at the commission. Okay. And but as futures trading developed more into the financial areas, there began to be questions of what kinds of financial futures could be traded, that would they or would they not have an impact on securities. And obviously, to some extent, they do, because simple arbitrage between various futures products and the securities products would have an effect. But it was it wasn't an issue that was at the top of the list. It was more, I think, people outside either the SEC or the CFTC making suggestions that, well, it really should be one one agency, and it was never something that was that there was any serious discussion about while I was at the SEC.
Just out of curiosity, why did financial futures start to develop in this at this time?
I think that part of it was entrepreneurial behavior by certain individuals in the futures markets. Okay. That I think that they begin seeing areas that that would work and had potentially more widespread interest than even the agricultural commodities. One that I would mention is Leo Melamed from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange was really one of the spark plugs in this, and I think that what was happening is expanding internationalization of the financial markets. Remember, one of the areas I think that began sort of financial futures was like in the area of foreign exchange. So that contributed, and I think just the sort of the growing importance of financial markets at the time created the opportunity. It wasn't that certainly that, regulators were out there leading the charge. It was more a development from market participants, and that the regulators were reacting to.
Okay. Are there other issues that stand out to you as being significant during your time as a commissioner?
Well, I think we've certainly hit the high points, and I'm not thinking of something where I say, you know, I'd like to make a comment about the following. I think you've done a pretty good job in posing questions.
Okay. You just cover what you've been doing since the commission. So you left the commission in 1989?
That's correct.
And did you come straight to Compass Lexicon at that point?
Yes. At that time, it was known simply as Lexicon. Okay. And then it's since then that we joined with the company Compass.
Okay.
To create Compass Lexicon. But yes, I joined Lexicon in 1989 and have been here ever since.
And what sort of things have you been doing since you've been here?
Well, I'm an economist here.
Okay.
Lexicon, and now Compass Lexicon, is a consulting firm that applies economic analysis to legal and regulatory matters, which means that basically I supervise research projects that are related to either litigation or various regulations, and from time to time I testify about the results of that research if it's litigation, and I found this to be kind of midway between what I did at the SEC mm-hmm. and what I did in academics. So mm-hmm. it was a happy mixture.
Yeah, sounds
for
like
me,
fun.
Put me in a good place as far
yeah.
as I had a good time at the SEC. I had a good time in academics, mm-hmm. so I've got some of both.
Sounds like it would be really engaging to direct these projects.
It is. You learn a lot about topical issues.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things I did want to ask about was you served for a couple of years as the chairman of the United Shareholders Association.
Yes, I did.
I'd be just curious as to what were the major issues that you faced while you were the chairman there.
The idea was that giving shareholders access to corporate decision making, and so it was corporate governance, mm-hmm. I guess. But by the time I was chairman of United Shareholders Association, the market for corporate control had changed somewhat. I think there weren't really the number or the importance of various takeovers, especially hostile takeovers, that had gotten more or less sorted out into various accommodations in state law, federal law, so forth. But one of the areas while I was at United Shareholders was the idea of how corporate management is paid. And the idea expressed at the time was it's not how much, it's how mm-hmm. that was the important question. Was it related to the performance of the corporation as far as shareholder value, or did it seem to be disassociated mm-hmm. from that? And so that was one primary area mm-hmm. of focus while I was at United Shareholders, and I believe that that partly United Shareholders was responsible for some of the ability of shareholders to have some say about pay in relation to how the the corporation had had performed financially. So that was the area that strikes me now as one of the most important while I was there.
Sort of the early days of say on pay and things like that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And another thing I would say is that that rather than become an organization that that spends all of its time raising funds, we decided that we were pretty much at a point where we didn't have a new major area mm-hmm. in which to proceed. And so we wound up the United Shareholders Association rather than saying, well, let's think of some ways to raise funds mm-hmm. and that become the driving force. I think we've done a pretty good job, and it was time to move on.
Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to discuss or that comes to your mind?
As I said before, we've covered a wide range of things that a lot of which happened a long time ago. I've done my best to come up with my most accurate recollections, and I can't think of something else that I would like to add to the interview.
Well, great. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, you're welcome, and it's been my pleasure, too. All right.